Hello, music lovers. Deborah Lynn here, composer, conductor, and professor. You're listening to What's the Score, a podcast about music and the brilliant people who create it. This week's podcast offers a little introduction to your host, which is me, Deborah Lynn, and also a little insight into my composition process. But first, today's composer quote. The essential conditions of everything you do must be choice, love, passion. Nadia Boulanger. This week in music history, a.k.a. mostly composer birthdays. On August 30th, 1952, Simon Bainbridge was born. On that same date in 1960, Kevin Oldham was born. He's a composer from my hometown, Kansas City, Missouri. On September 1st, 1994, interestingly, our President Bill Clinton designated September as Classical Music Month. Also on September 1st in 1608, Giacomo Torelli was born. With a name like that, you know that kid's going to grow up to be some kind of musician. Also on September 1st in 1653, Johann Pachelbel was baptized. We don't know what his birth date was, but we can presume that it was sometime before September 1st. On September 1st, 1854, Engelbert Humperdinck was born, not to be confused with the pop singer of the same name. Our guy composed the beloved opera Hansel und Gretel. In 1925, on September 1st, Ruth White was born. Yay, female composers! On that same day in 1931, Richard Hundley was born. On September 2nd, 1954, Stephanie Bennett, another female composer and harpist, was born. In 1995, on September 2nd, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame opened in Cleveland, Ohio. On September 3rd, 1568, Adriano Banchieri came into the world, and he's one of my favorite composers. On that same day in 1915, Knut Nystedt was born. Say that real fast three times, music nerds. Also, on September 3rd, 1967, Woody Guthrie passed away, as did Harry Partch in 1974. Harry Partch was a really interesting experimental composer, hung out at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana quite a bit. September 5th, 1824, was the birthday of Anton Bruckner. In 1892, Darius Milhaud was born on September 5th. And on that date in 1907, Edvard Grieg died. And on September 5th, 1946, Freddie Mercury was born. Imagine the world without Bohemian Rhapsody. Now that's a birthday to celebrate. I thought since this is my first podcast episode, I would start by giving a little introductory information about myself. I don't want to give my whole life story because, well, I'm not a young woman, so that would be a really long story. But I can give a few highlights. If you'd like to read my bio, you can find that at my blog site, which is deborahlynnmusic.org. But for now, I'll just give a few highlights and so you know who's talking to you. I'm a professor at Manchester University, not to be confused with the University of Manchester, which is in England. So you've probably already discerned from my accent that I am not an Englishwoman, but am in fact a Midwesterner in the United States. So indeed, Manchester University is located in North Manchester, Indiana. I was born in Independence, Missouri in 1963. Now you know how old I am for sure. My parents were both musicians, Joe and Barbara Driscoll. My dad sang in the Driscoll Brothers Quartet with three of his siblings. My mom was the neighborhood piano teacher and really helped me get started. I'm an advanced functional pianist. I play a lot just for my own pleasure and enjoyment. It's definitely a tool that I use when I compose, and I play for choral ensembles and voice students. I'm happy to collaborate, but not interested in being a piano soloist at all. But Mom really got me started with that. I'm pretty much self-taught. I don't think I had piano lessons on a regular basis until my senior year of high school. And I was already quite advanced by that time. I started writing songs when I was in about sixth grade. And my brother was also a musician. He died just over 12 years ago. His name is Gary Driscoll. And he was a contemporary Christian composer. I think I was about 10 years old when Gary started having me transcribe music off of records. He had formed a rock band with some of his friends. He was 6 years older than me. And my brother was a big fan of Chicago Transit Authority, which later became known just as Chicago. But one of the cool things about that group was they included winds in their music. That just hadn't been done much in rock music. So Gary wanted his basement rock band to be able to play some of those songs. So he would put the record on and just transcribe all the wind parts. He figured out that he could put me to work helping him transcribe these wind parts in half the amount of time it would take to do it by himself. You know, so he'd do the trumpet part and the saxophone part, and I'd do the trombone part or whatever. That's how I started thinking about writing music and really analyzing everything. And this was rhythmically complex stuff, too. It wasn't just about the pitches. I had to get the rhythms right. He was really my first composition teacher. Without intending to teach me to compose, he was starting to teach me to compose. I went to Truman High School in Independence, Missouri, and my high school choir director, Phil Dunham, saw potential in me as well. Just one day on a whim, I decided to write a choral arrangement of some of the songs from the Muppet movie, of all things. I'm pretty sure that was the first thing that I gave to Phil. I called it the Muppet Medley, and I had written a piano accompaniment and four-part harmony. I played it for him and he loved it. And he said, we're going to perform this. You know, I look back at that and think of how extraordinary that was to have that encouragement as a high schooler. He would have some ensemble sing everything I gave to him. So I'm so thankful that he did that for me. I wasn't giving him compositions at that point, but I was giving him arrangements. And so that's where I started as a composer. Then I went to William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri. It was about 20 miles from my house. And there's a longer story to my undergraduate degree that I'm not going to go into right now, but that is where I started my degree and where I finished it. I took a 4-year hiatus in the middle of it that I will probably never talk about on this podcast. But I had another terrific mentor there, Arnold Epley, who is my choral director. And he is another person who kept encouraging me to compose. So it's something I really appreciate about he and Phil both, because they were just so willing to program my work and let me explore it. I probably wouldn't have kept up with composing had it not been for their encouragement. I met my spouse, Robert Lynn, at William Jewell, and he is a cellist. Actually, he's a cellist and a tubist, so he's got both of those things going on. But he's a wonderful musician, and we got married not long after we both graduated. Then we went together to Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri. I considered majoring in composition at that time. I also had thought very seriously about an opera career. But I had aborted that mission because I had a daughter who was 4 at the time from my previous marriage. And she was diagnosed with autism just as I was starting my master's degree. So I had one of those, for lack of a better term, a come to Jesus moment where I realized that in order to parent her well, I probably would not be able to balance that with a career as an opera singer. So I decided to become a conductor, but I was a pretty talented voice teacher as well. So I always wanted to keep that going. I did study composition at Truman State University with Warren Gooch, and he's still a dear friend, and he was a great teacher. Warren challenged me a lot, and it made me a little angry at times, but I always knew that whatever he was asking me to do was good for me. I needed to learn it. He helped me embrace dissonance and made me write 12-tone pieces and things that I really never would have decided to compose on my own. When I finished my master's degree, I started my doctorate at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, but an interesting opportunity presented itself to serve as a sabbatical replacement for Dean Wilder, who had been my undergraduate voice teacher back at William Jewell College. So I decided to take that opportunity. It was a wonderful experience that really solidified for me how much I loved teaching voice and that it wasn't something I was ready to give up. So when it came time to continue my doctorate, I decided to go to Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, which offered a degree program that would allow me to concentrate in both voice and conducting. When I finished all my coursework at Ball State, I ended up here at Manchester University. I just finished my 21st year. I love it here. It's a great place. I had originally thought, well, I'll stick around for about 3 years and then I'll move on somewhere else. I'd been hopping in an eastward direction with each degree. A lot of my research interests are in the East Coast area. I love the music of Charles Ives. I enjoy studying colonial American music. So it would have made a lot of sense for me to end up somewhere like Boston or Connecticut, someplace like that. But Manchester has hung on to me. It's a place where I can wear a lot of hats. I can do many things. I conduct several ensembles, usually 3 or 4 every semester. I can still teach voice, and I teach vocal pedagogy. I teach conducting. I've taught a class on the history of the Requiem Mass. I've taught a class on stage and film music. I even taught a class on autism once, so totally outside the music area, but it's something I knew about because I have an autistic person living with me, so I'm not pigeonholed into one area, which is something I really love about this place. I also really appreciate the mission of the school. It's very peace and justice oriented, and I really admire that. So I've stayed here. I'm very happy in my little corner in Northeast Indiana. As far as composing goes, it's just something I've continued to do. So ever since high school, when I was writing those little arrangements and transcribing wind parts for my brother's rock band, that's just grown into this really wonderful interest area for me. Composition is something that just flows from me. It's not something that ever seems like it's really hard work. I feel like I keep improving. I keep challenging myself. I'm very much a workaholic anyway, so it's a good outlet for me. I don't really have time to compose, so I have to kind of turn off that spigot in late August. So I get from the start of June till mid to late August, about 2.5 months out of every calendar year when I can really devote time to composition. Usually when I open that valve, it's like a flood of creative energy. I'm just cranking stuff out all summer long. So, yeah, it's kind of a weird life. I work year-round, but I don't work as a professor year-round. I'm also a synesthete. If you don't know what that is, I have 3 forms of synesthesia, but the most common one is that I hear color. So I hear color and texture. That's a second form, but I have a spatial form of synesthesia that's numerically related. But it also plays into some of what I do musically. My composition process is really connected to that in a lot of ways, but I will try to explain some of that without getting too deep into the synesthete world. As far as my composition process goes, one of the first things I would say is that I never try to write lyrics. I used to do that when I was young, and I've discovered that I am not a poet. I really love working with text. It's one of my favorite things about composing. Self-awareness is a great thing as a composer. So if you're a composer out there, a young aspiring composer, learn what you can't do. It's great to be encouraged and believe in yourself. Sometimes you have to believe in yourself when nobody else will. But it's also really important to understand your limits. And poetry is a limitation that I have. I can interpret it, but I can't write it. I'm also visually impaired, so much so that I rely heavily on my ears and my tactile sensibilities to wend my way through this life. My composition process always starts at the piano. I don't stay at the piano a long time. I pretty quickly move to my computer and start entering things on Finale. But I always start at the piano with staff paper and a pencil. That's really important to me. There's something about putting my hands on the keyboard and feeling the way that my hands move from one place to another. It's almost like I'm in a little bit of a trance or something. I'm not, but I don't really look at the keys. I just start finding my way around. I hear everything in layers. This is part of the synesthesia. I hear the colors happening and the textures as I play. So it's really easy for me to decide where different pitches are going, where I want voices to lead from one into another. So I don't really think in harmonies. I don't think chords. It's one of the reasons I don't write songs. I write compositions. My brother was a songwriter. His process involved thinking about chord progressions and moving from one chord to another, one harmonic structure to another. I'm much more of a linear thinker, so I'm thinking about voicing all the time. So I start at the piano and I listen and I feel my way across the keys. I stop, I make notes. That seems to get the creative juices flowing. I'll spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes at the piano, and then I have enough that I can move to the computer, and I really then start hearing it in my head. From that point, I don't really need the piano anymore. I used to write everything from start to finish at the piano on manuscript paper, but now I've gotten to a point where I can really hear everything in my head. And thanks to all those music transcription exercises my brother had me do when I was a little kid, I can hear something in my head and I can transcribe it immediately. So that's really where my process starts. I will say, though, that I usually start with some kind of a form, and that's part of my piano work. Often that changes during the composition process. I get into something and I want to stay a little longer, or decide I don't want to go back to something I've already done. But I always start with a form in mind. When you're starting with a blank slate, you need to have a plan. Otherwise, you're just wandering. You're going to save yourself a lot of time if you create some kind of a plan to start with. Even if it goes out the window after 15 or 20 minutes, start with a plan. You need to see a path in front of you before you can veer off of it. Otherwise, you don't know that you're veering off of the path. I thought it might be kind of interesting. I'm going to just go over to the piano right now. And I'm going to just start noodling a little bit. And I'm not going to stop and write things down because that would be really boring to listen to. But just so that you can kind of hear what that feels like for me. A little starting point. Some of that I might keep, some of it I might not. The other thing that's really important for me is to save what I don't use. And for me, that's a little file folder in my computer, and I take those little bits and I stick them in there. when I get stuck for an idea, I go back to that and I'll pull something out. Oh, yeah, I remember this, and that was kind of a cool idea. And it might not fit in whatever I'm working on at the time, but it's good to just remind yourself that it's there. Digging through those scraps, whether they're physical scraps or electronic ones, is a really important exercise for composers, and that can be a motivating thing also. And it all goes in, and it all teaches you something. Something that's very important in my process is to make sure that I'm always challenging myself. I consistently try to write for instruments that I'm not used to writing for or that I'm a little bit afraid of. I'm getting ready to write something that will include some classical guitar. I purposely put that in because I need to learn to write for classical guitar. This is something I've just learned in the last 6 months. I need other people whose opinion I respect to look at my work critically and hold me accountable. I recently wrote something that I was trying to get feedback about, and I just couldn't get it. The people I was asking were really busy and just didn't have time to get back with me. And it was frustrating me a lot. I just almost stopped the project because I thought, I don't even know if this is playable. Again, I was writing for an instrument that I wasn't that familiar with, so I really, really needed that feedback, but I didn't have it. So I had to just go ahead. What I ended up doing was running it by another composer friend, somebody that I respect tremendously, and he gave me the confidence to keep going. He and I trade compositions back and forth a bit, and we have this trust, but there were some places in that piece that he really challenged me to dig deeper, but mostly, I got a lot of encouragement and a lot of, wow, this is really a good piece, which I felt, but there's always that honeymoon period when you're composing, you know, you love it because it's your child. So you really need somebody else to look at your work and tell you, well, maybe try this or maybe, but this is what's really good about it, and to sort of separate those elements. So that's been really helpful, and that's something that's important to my process as well. If you have questions or would like to suggest topics for future broadcasts, please visit my blog site at deborahlynnmusic.org and leave some comments on the podcast page. I would love to hear from you and will certainly address any questions you have. And now it's time for some recommended listening.
Eh? What's that, sweetie?
This week's recommended listening is a piece by Adriano Banchieri, who I mentioned before. September 3rd is his 452nd birthday, and so I thought it would be a good time to talk about his music, and he's one of my favorite composers. He lived in Bologna most of his life. This was before Italy was Italy, so Bologna was part of the Papal States, and sometimes you'll find his name written as Tommaso Banchieri, but he changed his name to Adriano at the tender age of 19 when he became a Benedictine monk. So I know what you're thinking. Why is this old geezer one of your favorite composers, Deborah Lynn? Well, it turns out Adriano was quite a brilliant fellow. He saw significant dramatic possibilities in madrigals. So he was a really innovative guy and was one of the developers of a form called madrigal comedy. These were unstaged dramatic cycles, basically, of madrigals, and they told a sort of a vague story when they were sung in a prescribed order. The subject matter for these madrigal comedies was usually something pretty bawdy and irreverent. Banchieri really liked to experiment with the sound of the voice and what it could do to imitate other things like animal noises or musical instruments. And he would parody various dialects from the region. So in some ways, he was the Weird Al Yankovic of his time. A single madrigal comedy was intended to provide an entire evening's entertainment. So they were sort of like the blockbuster film of the day. The one particular madrigal comedy that I want to suggest that you look up is called Barca di Venezia per Padova. It was composed in Venice originally in 1605. He made some revisions a little bit later, but that's the start date. And it involves an extraordinary cast of characters who are traveling on a barge. So he's kind of playing on some of the stereotypical aspects of people in various occupations or from different regions. But it's a really interesting take on the culture of the time. Some of the characters include a Venetian fisherman. There's a merchant from Brescia, a Florentine bookseller. There's a courtesan. There's a soldier. There's a host of other characters. So I'm going to play three little really short snippets for you. In this first one, the nasality of tone in a particular set of characters as they're arguing is explored. So this would have been universally understood and humorous at the time. In this next excerpt, the chorus is imitating the sound of the lute, which is like a precursor to the modern guitar. So all of the singers combine together to create the strings of the lute, except for one singer who performs a beautiful melody on top of the lute accompaniment. And in addition to these parodied, silly moments, there are also instances where you hear the beauty that Banchieri creates. And so this final excerpt is of that sort. You can hear how the chorus functions as a single, almost symphonic voice. And here they're representing the voice of a weary soldier returning home from war. So, happy birthday, Banchieri. And if you want to join me in celebrating his birthday, check out this little madrigal comedy. Once again, it's called Barca di Venezia Der Padova, and it's by Adriano Banchieri. If it helps to see that written out, visit my blog site where you can find a running list of all my recommendations. Thanks for tuning in to What's the Score? This is Deborah Lynn signing off. If you'd like to know more about me or my compositions, just wander on over to my blog site, deborahlynnmusic.org.